All Games Radio Online presents the Bobby Blackwolf Show, week of October 9th, 2005.
From a little room in Atlanta, Georgia, the show that gives gamers a voice, from a live broadcast to podcast, All Games Radio Online presents the Bobby Blackwolf Show.
For the next hour, we'll discuss the latest gaming news and gaming trends, as well as touching on your favorite classics. From Atari to Xbox, we'll talk about it all. Our Skype line is always open at Bobby Blackwolf Show, so if you can't be here for our live Sunday night broadcast, feel free to voice your opinion for a future episode. To participate in our live broadcast, join us in the AllGames.com chat room on the GameSurge IRC network or on our forums at AllGames.com.
And now, Bobby Blackwolf.
Gone too far for Hotkins.
Thank you.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Bobby Blackwolf Show, where we discuss the current news affecting the video game industry, as well as reminisce about gaming's history. I'm Bobby Blackwolf. For the live folks, we are hanging out in the AllGames.com chat room on the GameSurge IRC network, and our Skype line is Bobby Blackwolf Show, all one word. For the podcast folks, feel free to call our Skype line's voicemail with your thoughts on any topic in the gaming industry, or just leave an email at blackwolf@allgames.com, and you might hear yourself on the air. And as always, thanks to Kropotkin for providing the short UK news segment that runs just before this show goes live, which is available as a podcast feed for those who cannot tune in live. Check it out on our website at allgames.com/podcast or at his site, kropotkin.co.uk. His inflection, not mine. For those of you that are listening because you heard of us through All Games Interactive, which is Scott Rubin's new radio show, welcome. This is an independently done podcast. I'm the only person that does it. I do it out of my spare bedroom with a little, you know, $20 karaoke microphone using old Winamp software from 2001. So, you know, this ain't exactly the professional one, but we have a good time. And for those of you that couldn't listen to the All Games Interactive feed, don't worry, you were not alone. What essentially happened is that the internet connection between the radio studio in Culver City, California, and our Shoutcast server, which is a dedicated server that does really well, that link was kind of bad. So when he tried to send it over, it would buffer on between him and the server, and so we would all buffer and get loops and all that stuff. So that is not the software we were using. It was just the connection from Culver City to the Shoutcast server. There are MP3 files that he's already got the first hour up. He's going to work on the second 2 hours. If you go to that website, allgames.com/interactive, and you go to the official forums, you'll see some threads by AGN, All Games Interactive Part 1, Part 2. Those are the MP3 files. Unfortunately, in the interest of time, I was not a part of the broadcast, but hopefully if it gets picked up by other radio stations, I will be. This week on this show, we are actually going to air the first of a two-part interview with a man named Kurt Vendel. Now, you've probably never heard of him, but after this interview, you will. He is, in my mind, the foremost historian on Atari and has worked with the current Atari as project manager for both the Flashback and the Flashback 2 consoles. Now, this was a long interview. We did it over the telephone this past Saturday afternoon, and the entire interview came down to 37 minutes, and I said, there's no way I'm going to air a 37-minute interview on the show. And I was listening to it, and there's just nothing I wanted to cut out of it. So we're going to air it in two parts. Tonight we're going to air the first about 19 minutes where he discusses his involvement with Atari, some of the tasks in creating the Flashback and Flashback 2, what's on the Flashback 2, and next week we'll actually be asking some questions about like the technical side of things, some questions that were posed by forum members, and how you can extend the life of the Flashback 2. So, but tonight we're going to air the first part of it, so that's going to be coming up. But some of the big news that we're going to touch on first is about the Xbox 360. How's that for going from Atari 2600 to Xbox 360? The X05 press event in Amsterdam was Microsoft's latest showing of the Xbox 360. But how much information was really shown? One of the biggest questions about the launch lineup for November 2nd, and many industry analysts hoped that Microsoft would share some information with us about the launch titles, but they didn't. GameSpot did get to the heart of the matter. They asked David Reed, who's the director of platform marketing for the Xbox, what the exact 360 launch lineup was, because they had some conflicting press releases and stuff. He said that, quote, there will be 15 to 20 Xbox 360 titles available on launch day, with another half dozen making it to market by the end of the year, unquote. For the moment, though, he would only confirm 8 games being available on the same day as the date for the Xbox 360, and those games are Project Gotham Racing 3, Cameo, Perfect Dark Zero, Madden NFL 06, NBA Live 06, Tiger Woods PGA Tour 06, Need for Speed Most Wanted, and FIFA 06 Road to the FIFA World Cup. As for the other 7 to 12 Xbox 360 games that will be available on November 22nd, Reed said that they would be announced in the next few weeks. They are currently in the final stages of certification, he told GameSpot, referring to the quality assurance process all third-party games must go through with their respective console maker. So it is likely that any of the submitted games, which Reed declined to mention, do not pass the process sometimes in the next fortnight. They may not make it to the market by the end of the year. One of the other tidbits that came out of XO5 for the Xbox 360 is an interview that Jay Allard had about the hard drive. Edge Online, which is a UK website, reports that in an interview during that conference, Xbox 360 platform chief Jay Allard has addressed questions surrounding the company's decision to ship two versions of its upcoming hardware, one with a hard drive and one without. Faced with the suggestion that Microsoft might have let down developers by removing the guarantee of a hard drive in every box, Allard said, quote, I don't know who we've let down. There isn't a game on 360 that you can't play without a hard drive, so I think it's a good thing for consumers. We've made a commitment to broadening the audience, and while I think that most of our energy here at XO5 is about the hardcore, over time, we're really setting the stage for making this a bigger category for everybody. So from the developer point of view, you have the best tools and the commitment of the most well-resourced company in the world going worldwide with this product and saying that we want to grow the audience. So it seems like a win for developers. I'm not sure who's supposed to be disappointed. But Saints Row developer Volition, they're the ones that have expressed difficulty in realizing some of its ambitions since the removal of the hard drive. There's some issues with streaming and caching. Jay Allard responded with, quote, sometimes doing the right thing means doing the hard thing. Are there developers who are disappointed? Yeah, sure. Okay, he says that, and then he says, I don't know who we've let down. So he already kind of reversed his position. Anyway, back to the quote. I wish there was a hard drive, and I wish there were 4 terabytes of memory. I wish it were free to consumers, and I wish we could put one in every TV set. There are a lot of wishes that I have at the end of the day that we're trying to run a business, and you have to make these trade-offs. It was a difficult one. I was the biggest fan of the hard drive and its potential, but the problem is that we sold 22 million Xbox consoles, and 5 million, maybe 10 million, just don't care about the hard drive. But we paid for it. Who pays for it this time? We can either ask the gamer to pay for it ourselves, or prove that there's enough value in it and have the gamer say, I want to pay for it. I think that's the right model, unquote. He goes on to talk about how confusing it is. I'm kind of torn on this issue because I don't think that the developers adequately used the hard drive in the Xbox. They could have really used it really well for like caching and load times, especially in games like Burnout Revenge, where you wind up restarting the level a lot once you realize that once you crash once, you have to go back and restart your level. But nobody really used it. And, you know, custom soundtracks are great and all, but nobody used it for anything more than custom soundtracks. So in that sense, Jay Allard has a point. The Raven says that Jay Allard doesn't understand what he's saying. I think he just talks. This is the same way he talked when discussing Nintendo. He said EA didn't care for it, but when the controller was shown, EA was already quoted as saying that they can't wait to develop for it. And this is true. I mean, you know, I don't have that article queued up, so I can't really talk about it all that much. But Jay Allard was quoted by 1UP as saying, you know, nobody's going to play Madden on the Revolution controller. Nobody plays Madden on a Nintendo console anyway. So, you know, it doesn't matter. EA loves having the innovative stuff. They are on board with the DS. They're going to be on board with the Revolution. I don't think that's going to be a problem. Interlogic says, the hard drive is not a standard IDE drive. At least it does not look like it. This is bad. I can't go get the basic system and hook up a normal IDE hard drive. That would save me money. Microsoft's all about making the money, and that's the thing on that. Hard drives are pretty cheap, so it would save money to actually buy your own hard drive and put it in like you can with the PS2. But I don't think Microsoft's going to go that way, and it wouldn't make business sense for them to go that way. Fifth Dream says, do Blinks and Prince of Persia use the hard drive? Yes, they do, and they're pretty much the only ones that use the hard drive in any kind of a good, decent manner. I'm going to open up our Skype line. Bobby Blackwolf Show on Skype. Unfortunately, to those listeners out there who live in California, the governor kicked your ass. CNET sadly reports that Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger signed legislation on Friday to outlaw the sale of to teenagers of electronic games featuring reckless mayhem and explicit sexuality in the state of California. The governor's approval of the bill was in doubt until the last minute when he signed it as a part of a series of measures that he said would protect children and strengthen families. The video game industry, which has sales of more than $7 billion a year and is largely based in California, lobbied heavily against the bill and vowed to challenge it in court, saying it violated the First Amendment guarantees of free speech. The video game measure is similar to bills passed recently in Illinois and Michigan, but is expected to have far broader impact because of the size of the California market and the state's role in blazing national trails on social issues. The bill bans the sale or rental to those under 18 of any video games that, quote, depict serious injury to human beings in a manner that is especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel, unquote. Violations carry a fine of up to $1,000. The bill passed with wide bipartisan majorities and was endorsed by a broad range of family and medical associations, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and the California Parent Teacher Association. Many of these games are made for adults, and choosing games that are appropriate for kids should be a decision made by their parents, Schwarzenegger said in a statement. The issue of violence in video games is not new, with numerous games that arm players with fantastically powerful weapons used to kill or dismember their enemies, such as games starring Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, added by me. But the issue erupted into the national scene in recent years with the popularity of Grand Theft Auto. The games made by Take-Two Interactive reward a player for undertaking various criminal pursuits, including shooting rivals and stealing cars. The games are rated M for mature, and they are intended for players 17 and older. The latest version of the game, Grand Theft Auto San Andreas, caused a particular uproar because it included a sexually explicit animated scene that had not been disclosed to the ESRB, which rates video games. The bill sponsor is Assemblyman Leland Yee, a child psychologist and former school administrator. Yee, a Democrat from San Francisco, said he expected the measure to survive court challenge because it was carefully written to outlaw the sale or rental of such games to minors, not to punish the writers or publishers of the games. He said there's growing scientific evidence linked to the playing of the games by impressionable teenagers and preteenagers to acts of violence or hostile attitudes towards girls and women. Quote, study upon study shows that these ultra-violent games have harmful effects on our children, unquote. That's what Leland Yee said. Douglas Lowenstein, president of the Entertainment Software Association, the main trade group for the video game industry, said in a statement that he expected the courts to declare the California law invalid as they have in other jurisdictions. And he says, quote, we are disappointed that politicians of both parties chose to toss overboard the First Amendment and free artistic and creative expression in favor of political expediency, unquote. Part of me is happy to see this, part of me isn't, because one thing to note, the California law does not follow the ESRB's rating system at all. There could be a game that's rated E that will have this 18 sticker put on it. The good thing is, you know, for like independent publishers, they don't have to get their game rated by the ESRB if they want to be sold in California. But it's still, you know, I guess part of me, I'm all for restricting the purchasing of these games by minors. And I'm probably against the majority on that one. I would rather make it more difficult for a 14-year-old to buy Grand Theft Auto than for there not to be a Grand Theft Auto at all. There's nothing in this bill that restricts a minor playing a game. It only restricts the purchase. Massman says that Leland lies, and that's correct. In this article, Leland Yee says that you know, there's all these studies that show this, that. There's also a whole bunch of studies that show exactly the opposite. And there, you know, it just, whichever studies you want to believe, you just latch on to those. Gita says that this law sets a precedent that could allow music and movies to be restricted as well. That and that kind of gets to me, you know, why are we only attacking the video game industry? Why is it not a global, entertainment thing going against movies and music and books? You know, why don't we restrict the sale of books that deal with the dismemberment of humans in it? Why don't we restrict movies, World War II movies? Why don't we actively restrict those? Some movie theaters restrict viewing. Bobby Blackwell Show, you're on the air. Who is this?
Hey, Bobby, it's the Raven.
Hey, what's on your mind?
I just wanted to comment on the Grand Theft Auto thing with Arnold Schwarzenegger and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
What I've seen from the news about Grand Theft Auto being terrible and stuff, it's all been like grandmothers that bought this game for their kid and saying, oh, I didn't know it was so violent and stuff, even though it had the M rating on it. So I just wanted to comment on that because of Arnold Schwarzenegger. I didn't really understand it that well, but saying that kids are prohibited from buying this game, but that's been happening already. It's the grandparents and stuff that don't understand about these games.
Right, and I mean, that was one of the things that was touched on. But basically, what I think what Arnold Schwarzenegger is trying to do, and at least what Leland Yee is trying to do, is to put the power back into the parents. And, you know, I do applaud him. You know, Leland Yee, as much as he's probably been vilified and stuff, and he's probably said some stuff that deserves to be vilified, he is not going after the game publishers. He's not saying, hey, game publishers, you should not release these games. He's not saying that.
Right.
You know, there are some people, like some guy down in Miami, who says, you should not make these games. You know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, at least Leland Yee is not saying that. And, you know, I would much rather have seen the retailers voluntarily follow the ESRB and restrict the sales of M-rated games to minors themselves without having the law step in.
Right. Well, I would hope that parents would already understand that when it says M rating 18 and older on a title, that they wouldn't get their kids the game. But obviously that's not the case.
Yeah, that's not the case. And I mean, even you could even title the game, like Grand Theft Auto, you could title the game as after a crime, and parents will
right.
still buy it thinking, oh, it's just a video game, you know, games for kids, they're toys, yeah, here you go. You know, so
right, and that's what gets me pissed off. I mean, parents have to understand that they have to have some responsibility in this as well, and they just can't have the government telling them this kind of stuff. I mean, it's on the box.
Right.
I really don't see how much more simpler it could get.
And, I mean, a lot of retail stores actually show, like, they describe the ESRB ratings on big poster board, on the shelves, you know, and everything. So it's not
right.
that people don't know, and there's PSAs all over television from, you know, Regis Philbin's done one, Derek Jeter's done one, Tiger Woods. They've all said,
yeah.
they've all said, you know, ESRB is here to help you. It's helped you make an informed decision because, you know, games are entertainment for all ages. But some games are not for all ages, and, you know, that should point it out. Thanks for your call,
all right.
man.
All right, no problem, dude.
Bobby Blackwolf Show on Skype. Interlogic says, parents probably think that M rating means monkey or money. Hey, free money. Yeah. The Matrix says that his dad wouldn't let him get Manhunt. I think that's a good thing because Manhunt kind of sucked. And the Matrix actually has, but he got it anyways, and it sucked. So it was probably a good thing. Your dad was probably trying to save you from sucky games. Going to go into another story here, kind of going away from this. Let's talk about Nintendo. Gamma Sutra reports that Nintendo officials have held a press conference in Tokyo in which the company has revealed more details of its plans for the Nintendo Wi-Fi connection service and several new games for the Nintendo DS. The company will launch the Nintendo Wi-Fi connection in autumn, with two compatible titles being published by the company, Animal Crossing Wild World on November 23rd and Mario Kart DS on December 8th. That's in Japan. The games will be free to play online, although Nintendo will not prevent third-party publishers from charging fees. The marketing campaign for the service in Japan will be organized around the tagline, easy, safe, free. In Japan, Nintendo has organized over 1,000 free Wi-Fi access points in game stores around Japan, but has also developed a Nintendo-branded USB adapter in partnership with Japanese internet company Buffalo. Full worldwide pricing for the adapter is not wholly available, although a Mario Kart DS-related press announcement has confirmed that the Nintendo Wi-Fi USB connector will be priced at around $52 in the United Kingdom, £30, $52, and the Japanese price for the connection will be 3,500 yen, which is around $31. Over here in North America, the release of Animal Crossing Wild World has been delayed, making Mario Kart DS the first available Wi-Fi compatible game when it is released here on November 14th and in Europe on November 25th. Details released at the conference list four Wi-Fi multiplayer options for the game, including users to play with previously registered friends, random national players, random international players, and with rivals. The adapter is like this little USB dongle. It's about the size of those USB thumbsticks, thumb drives, and it will allow you to... It will act if you don't have a wireless access point in your house. if you have a wireless access point in your house, basically, it, from what I'm hearing, is that it will work with your existing access point. Now, hopefully it'll work if you've got it secured, because I'm not going to unsecure my access point just to play my DS, but I think they should have the password, the web encryption and stuff in there. Massman says that it sounds like a condom, the tagline, and actually the entire Nintendo DS tagline is touching is good, so you can, they're probably building on that. Gita says, is that before or after the 360 release? November 14th is when Mario Kart DS is going to be released in the U.S., and that's before the 360 release. Ryu DeBurnator says that he'll be enjoying Burnout Legends while you are playing Mario Kart DS. Different games for different people. I'm looking forward to playing Mario Kart DS online. I'd love to play some of you guys on there. Once we know how it works and how if there's like an actual gamer tag type thing, I'll let you know what it is, and we can probably get some Mario Kart DS going. Tiger Claw, is it backwards compatible with USB 1.0? Not sure. I hope so, because I only have USB 1.0, so if I need to get one because it won't work with my access point, then I hope I can still do it. Let's talk about the PSP a little bit, and this is actually a warning to those of you who have PSPs that probably run... That probably like looking around on the net for files. 1UP.com reports that Symantec security response experts identified the first Trojan that targets the PSP. It's called Trojan.PSP Brick, and it's a Category 1 threat, Category 5 being the worst. The virus is designed to look like a downloadable hack that lets users run their own games on the PSP. Once installed, it deletes system files and breaks the PSP. The user must choose to download it, which means that you're safe if you don't go around taking files from strangers. 1UP spoke with Oliver Fredericks, senior manager at Symantec Security Response, who provided some more details on the PSP Trojan. Fredericks warned that although there are still no confirmed cases of infection, quote, this should raise awareness. This is a trend we expect to see increase, unquote. Fredericks confirmed that the virus, which masquerades as a mod, is something that users have to download to deliberately get around the Sony PSP security system. People will not be affected if they don't arbitrarily download unknown files. Unfortunately, those who may have inadvertently installed the Trojan.PSP brick are out of luck. Symantec warns that it will delete critical system files and essentially break your PSP. Quote, you'll have to send it back to Sony for repairs, unquote. Of course, any kind of hack or mod not endorsed by Sony violates the license agreement and voids the warranty on the PSP, but as Fredericks noted philosophically, some gamers are going to do it anyway. How is Symantec going to keep up with the new attacks on consumer electronics? Quote, we are looking at emerging technologies, unquote, is what Fredericks acknowledged. For now, the security response team is looking at these viruses on a case-by-case basis, but that may not be enough in the coming year. Quote, this is an early indication of what's to come. Symantec has no record of a virus that specifically targets the Xbox system, for example, but it could easily happen. Basically, anything with an operating system is vulnerable, unquote. So just as a warning on that, just don't download arbitrary files to your PSP, even though there's a lot of sites out there that don't look reputable, you know, especially if you're talking about hacking or modifying and stuff like that. There are some that are reputable. PSP Updates is a reputable one. There's probably a couple other reputable sites that won't try to destroy your PSP, but you really need to look out for it. And, you know, if you have Symantec, it'll detect this Trojan. Okay, going back to the DS, the Raven can't find the link, but basically he explains it. In a nutshell, it gives your DS a unique 7-digit number, like a phone number, and you can give people your phone number so they can connect to you or just do the random connection. So I wonder how long it's going to be before somebody does 4, 8, 15, 16, 23, 42. That's a little bit too much. Oh, Interlogic, who's my resident PSP hack expert that I kind of look to, he says PSP updates sucks, so apologize for that. So many ads and schemes. PSP news at DCEMU is good. So PSP news at DCEMU gets the Interlogic seal of approval, and I'll go with that. We're going to go ahead into our interview with Kurt Vendel, who is the project manager for the Atari Flashback and the Atari Flashback 2.0. This is the first part of two interviews. This interview basically describes what the Flashback is and some of the story behind how he got started with it and some of the things that you can play on it out of the box. So you're listening to the Bobby Blackwolf Show on All Games Radio Online.
Kurt Vendel, thanks for spending some time with us here on the Bobby Blackwolf Show. First, what is the Atari Flashback 2?
Robbie, thank you for having me. The Atari Flashback 2 is Atari's second entry into the all-in-one TV plug-and-play gaming market. It's unlike the other products that are out on the market today, the joysticks and the controllers. This is actually a console system. It's actually a full-blown console with detachable joystick controllers that plug into it.
Now, how did you get started working with Atari to do this console?
Well, I have to kind of step back a little bit before that. Mm-hmm. I was contacted by Atari probably about late 2002, basically as a resource for their legal, marketing, some of their licensing division started contacting me. What happened was, over the years, Atari's owners have basically, you know, as each new owner took hands, they would basically throw, half the company away. So every time the company got taken over, they'd throw half of it out, keep throwing it out, until eventually it wound up in the hands of Infogrames, a French-owned company that bought out Hasbro Interactive, Atari Interactive, Microprose, a slew of other U.S. companies to create this sort of U.S. software juggernaut. And what is left of Atari was so minuscule that they really had no knowledge or understanding. They had no marketing materials, no assets. So they had been tapping me to get questions, find out about ownership of licenses, patents, get their hands on software and sources and stuff that I actually, over the last 25 years, through Atari Museum, had collected. So I was doing that for a while, and I was brought in on numerous occasions to consult on various in-house products and third-party products. And as time went by, I was getting in front of several key people in the management levels and pitching and discussing the possibility of Atari re-entering the hardware market and not just being a software house and doing small products, doing accessories, controllers, things like that. The same sort of thing that Microsoft did in the beginning. They were selling joypad controllers and flight sticks and so on and so forth, and you know, they built themselves up. So that was part of what I had pitched to them. And then after assisting them with their Jack-specific 10-in-1 joystick, that's when I said to them, I said, why aren't you doing this yourself? There's more money and revenue for you to make in your own pocket. Plus, we could do things in a far better level. So I began pitching the idea of, you know, let's do a new console. So for about a year and a half, that went on, and it was an interesting idea, but no one really moved on it. And then in May 2004, I got the phone call asking me to come up for a meeting at Atari. And when I got up there, you know, the whole boardroom filled with people, and they basically said to me, okay, Kurt, you got the green light. Make us a console. And I was like, okay, thanks for the notice. Came back 2 weeks later with the full timeline and production works of reproducing the Atari 2600/7800 console. And the timeline was basically 4 months to get a basic chip development done, and then an additional 2 months to get it productized and can begin production. And that's when I was informed that, well, that's not going to work because they wanted a product out for the 2004 holiday season, and it had to start shipping off of the manufacturing docks by the end of September. so that basically gave me, just under 2 months, and then when everything finally got signed, sealed, and you know, the official green light went, we then had 10 weeks to do something, and that's where Flashback 1 came out. Basically, it was done after the hardware that was already out on the market that Jax was doing with its joysticks, and Radica, and a couple of other companies. So you had a little miniature 7800, but there really wasn't an Atari core inside of it, and the games had to be rewritten, and with such a small window for development time, unlike the Jax products, the Radica products, they work 6 to 8 months. We had 10 weeks, and we had to do 20 games where they've done 5. So it was real difficult. We spent 14, 16-hour days consistently for 10 weeks straight. It was a little harrowing, but I got to do it again. I would definitely step up to the plate. And sales of it did remarkably well, despite the fact that it was not what everyone wanted. It probably got criticized more than any other plug-and-play product on the market, only because it was an Atari product. People expected better, expected more from Atari, so it got hammered, even though some of the games were far better than the Jacks and the Radical offerings, and some of the other games were, unfortunately, they just didn't come out very well, and they were not good in execution. But December of 2004 rolled around, the sales figures were far better than what Atari expected, and they brought me back in to discuss successor to Flashback, which was going to be Flashback 2, or actually it was going to be Flashback 2.0, as we were calling it in-house. The stipulation was that when I came in, I said, okay, I said, I want to do the console, but this time I've got to have certain areas of flexibility. I said, I need to be able to call a longer time period for development on this one. I want to do it properly, which means I want to do a real Atari chip inside of it, and I'd like to be a little bit more aggressive on the game selection that was going to be placed into the unit. Plus, there were certain features that I wanted to place into the unit that was basically going to generate buzz and excitement, and essentially, give Atari a little bit of extra free PR, because people were going to talk about some of the special sort of built-in features of the console. And we negotiated. Atari gave the green light on it, and we showed a preliminary prototype in February of 2005, running 9 or 10 games on it, and we were still at the point where we were still developing the hardware, but Atari still hadn't given us the full sign-off for development of new games, which were part of the stipulation, and the new menu system, and actually going into production until late April. So late April came around, we finally got all of the contractual parts of that done, and wham, we were off and going, and now it was time to run around and do multiple things on multiple fronts, which was the hardware development, the menu development, finishing up the listing of the games, refining the list, then going out, talking to the homebrew authors, because one of the key elements of Flashback 2, part of my stipulation was I wanted homebrew titles on the console. So contacting the homebrew authors, asking them two things. One was, would you like to have one of your existing games custom tweaked for the this new Atari platform that would be exclusively sold on it? And second, would you be interested in developing games? A couple of authors were interested in tweaking their game to have it put on the console. Nobody was willing to step up to the plate with only 2 months to develop a game. So we ended up having to go with an old software house that was knowledgeable in assembly language, which was going to be needed to create the new games on the 2600 console. And these new games were some of the arcade games, some of the computer games, some sequels that had never been done on the 2600 platform. So we were doing games like an arcade port of Lunar Lander, Asteroids Deluxe, Space Duel. We were going to do sequels to Adventure. We were going to do an Adventure 2 based on working closely with the homebrew author Ron Lloyd, who was creating Adventure 2 for the 5200, doing a sequel to Yar's Revenge called Yar's Return, which would be similar in its feel and flavor, but adding some additional challenge and twist to it, and then going and pulling out some prototypes and such. So it was a matter of, we really wanted to get the homebrew authors to write the games, because obviously they've got the heart and soul for this. They know the system probably better than just about anybody. Unfortunately, nobody was willing to step up to the plate and take on the challenge. So we had to go with a company that had never touched the 2600 platform ever, but knew assembly, and they basically took a crash course in 2 months, understanding the console and then writing a slew of new games. And the games came out well. They came out, some of them came out outstanding, some of them came out subpar, because it's difficult. Anybody who programs on a 2600 console knows it's a bear. Where, you know, you're not working on like a PC platform where you've got a menu of available high level languages, and you can do stuff in Visual Basic, Visual C, and Flash, or whatever you know your particular interest of programming is. That are, you know, a lot of these are cookie cutter programming languages where you can just piece stuff together, and you could make a game in a couple of days when you're talking directly. You know, in assembly, you're talking directly to the machine, and you know you've got to work from scratch. It's not an easy thing to do, and you know some of the games have slight little like hiccups, like they get out of sync, they jump a little bit. Others have a little too much flicker than most people are used to. But overall, they had good solid gameplay. You know, the mechanics are there, good sound effects. I think if, for instance, like a game like Caverns of Mars, if the flicker could just be reduced a little bit on it, it's a phenomenal game. I mean, as far as gameplay is concerned, it's a great game. Space Duel is a little jumpy. It needed a little bit of syncing. You know, Asteroids Deluxe is a great game, but occasionally you get a little jumpiness on it. So, you know, there are a couple of games there which, you know, brand new for everyone to play, but they've got some issues with them because if you're not really a hardcore, 2600 programmer and really know the system, you know, very well, it can be a little difficult programming them. So that was you know, one of the areas where we jumped into and, you know, got some new stuff to put on the table. The other side was going through all the cabinets of Atari and pulling out prototypes which had been done by Atari but had never been officially released. While a lot of these were, you know, floating around on the web, that's great for the community and the hardcore gamers, the people that are sort of in the know and know where to find these prototype games. But for the common layman, for the person who's, you know, going and shopping for a product like this, they probably never knew these prototypes existed. So here's a great opportunity to play some really good games, some fun games, like Save Mary and Aquaventure and Combat 2. Those are, you know, just great games which deserve to be, you know, put into the spotlight and see their, you know, their day in the sun, so to speak. So that was important. And from the homebrew authors, we got some nice games. Climber 5 was redone and tweaked by Dennis Debrow, and he turned that into Atari Climber, so it's an Atari themed version of his game. In fact, it even has a nice opening screen with a building and a little boy, you know, waving from the rooftop, and it's got a big Atari billboard on it. Tony Wong, who wrote Haunted Adventure, which was a hack of the adventure game, we included a tweaked out version of his game called Return to Haunted House, and that's just a great, great sequel. It's a very hard sequel to the original Haunted House, which really challenges people. I was personally involved with creating Adventure 2, which is a 2600 version of Ron Lloyd, who's creating a 5200 version of it. So it's based on his whole storyline and basically the idea of the Four Kingdoms and the map that he supplied to me is roughly reproduced, just about maybe a quarter of the size because of the memory limitations. In fact, even adding the fourth castle into the program ended up giving me some issues with occasional sync jumps on the screen because trying to track all the dragons in the Four Kingdoms with the bat occasionally causes a little bit of a hiccup. It's very difficult to create such a vast new game such as this, but it's a really fun game, and everyone seems to be enjoying Adventure 2. And then just the games that are already out there, the games that everyone knows, we picked out a real diverse selection, things that are extremely simple, like Dodgem and Maze Craze and 3D Tic-Tac-Toe, to, you know, the more complex games that people like to play, plus, of course, the staples of Atari, Missile Command, Centipede, Asteroids. And we actually tweaked Asteroids a little bit with a hack and created an arcade Asteroids that's got the more vectorized look instead of the original filled-in Asteroid ship. So, you know, there's a lot to offer there. You know, there's 40 games that you can, you know, get to right off the bat. And then by queuing in a sequence at the menu with your joystick, by moving up and down to do 1972, which is Atari's year of incorporation, you'll reveal a hidden menu in the console that's got two additional games, and those two additional games are paddle games, Super Breakout and Warlords. And you can play Warlords with, you know, two sets of paddles, so four people can play, which is a great thing, and Super Breakout is a great paddle game in general. And the reason why they're hidden is because the console came with joysticks. And they're not coming with a set of paddles, and you can't sell a console with paddle games if you're not supplying the actual controllers to play them. So to keep the cost down, we only supply joysticks to the console, but we hid some games in there for people to find and play and to be able to enjoy using the paddle games. There's another game in the console that also plays paddle, which is a new version of Pong called Arcade Pong, which looks very, you know, it's a little bit closer to the Arcade Pong, and is a sort of an improvement over the original Video Olympics Pong. And that one, thanks to Grand Idea Studios, Joe Brand, who supplied the paddle sense routine, that program will play with joysticks, but if you plug in a set of paddles, it senses the paddles are plugged in, and you can also play with the paddles. So you've got a game that actually can use multiple types of controllers, which is a nice, neat twist, and lets people who would come and say, well, it's a nice Pong program, but it would have been better if I could play paddle. Well, guess what? It's a nice Pong program, and you can play with the paddles the way, you know, everyone sort of expects it should be played. And, you know, we put that in there. So there was a lot of attention to detail, and that extends to the actual case itself. It's an exact two-thirds replica of the Atari 2600 console, and it got a little modern facelift. We did away with the stereo toggle switches, and we gave it a little bit of a modern look so that we kind of bring it up into the, you know, the 2000s here. And the joysticks are, we spent a great deal of time, went back and forth for quite a few weeks with the mechanical engineers, and we took the original Atari CX-40 joysticks, and we created the first time ever a successor to the joysticks called the CX-40Bs. And these are the new Flashback 2 joysticks. They're a great improvement over the original, both in their electronics and in their physical design. We looked at the issues with the original rubber boot that would pull off the top of the joysticks, the hollow plastic shaft that tended to weaken and not give enough tactile push on the buttons inside to make contact. So we redid that with a nice solid shaft with a rubber ring base on it. Inside, everything is gold contacts on a PCB board with conductive rubber contacts inside. And we spent a real good amount of time thickening the rubber around the actual conductive rubber contacts so that it's got that good solid feel to it. The fire button's got a good solid push up and down tactile feel to it. And they're electrically compatible with the old console, so you've got a fresh set of joysticks you could use on your old equipment, but vice versa, and more important, is now you can take your old console controllers, your trackball that played Missile Command and Centipede and Millipede, play it on the console, your paddle controllers, as I mentioned. Maybe you've got a Wico, you know, joystick that you've always loved better than an Atari joystick. You know, you plug it in and use that too. So, you know, that added a nice amount of flexibility for everybody.
Thank you very much, Kurt Vendel. That was part one of the interview. He just went on, and it was just so fascinating. Gita and Chad is also fascinated by it, knowing, he went into detail about current processes, but doing it in a retro manner and how hard it was to get that retro system out for the current market. So I want to thank you, Kurt Vendel, for taking the time out to talk with us. We will play part two next week, where he goes into questions that are posed by some of our forum members and talking about some more of the hard details on the technical side. And we also actually ask him what his favorite current-gen game is, which is usually a reversal from what people get asked. You know, usually you hear, what's your favorite classic game? Well, I ask him the opposite. That's going to be next week here on the Bobby Blackwolf Show. He is also the webmaster of AtariMuseum.com. So if you want to go check out some Atari memorabilia, just about all of it is there at AtariMuseum.com. I wanted to go back. I'm going to scroll back up through chat here because the Raven, talking about the Nintendo Wi-Fi connection going back into 2005 here, he posted a link He didn't post a link, but he posted some stuff here I'm going to read. To connect with someone using the Nintendo Wi-Fi connection, you must know them, and you must have them on your friends list, and they must have you on their friends list. The friends list is accessible at any time during the game, and there are two ways to register someone on your friend list. The first way you can do it is, when using LAN mode, just tap the friends icon and tap the name of the player you want to add to your friends list, and they're instantly added to it. The second method is using the friend registration key, which you get when you register with the Nintendo Wi-Fi connection. You can then ask your friend for their key using the phone, through an email, or any other means you can think of. So that's how this 7-digit number that you're going to be assigned is sent around. We're running down to the end of the show here. Some of the other stories that I really wanted to mention here. The employees finally won. Reuters reports that Electronic Arts, the world's largest video game company, said Wednesday it will pay $15.6 million to settle a lawsuit filed by current and former graphic artists seeking overtime pay. The proposed settlement of the class action lawsuit, which was filed in July of 2004, must be approved by the California Superior Court in San Mateo County. The employees charged that EA violated labor laws requiring it to pay overtime and were seeking past due overtime pay and penalties. Under the settlement, about 200 entry-level artists will become hourly workers eligible for overtime pay and a one-time grant of restricted EA stock. These employees will be excluded from bonuses and stock option grants, said Jose Martin, head of human resources for EA's Global Studios. A similar lawsuit filed in February by EA programmers is still pending. The lawsuits signify a changing view among some workers at Silicon Valley companies, where employees have traditionally traded long, unstructured work hours for the chance to get rich with stock option grants. Wedbush Morgan securities analyst Michael Pachter said EA will get productivity gains from the charges and, if it needs to, will control costs by weeding out slower workers. He said that the artists who are reclassified as hourly would likely get more supervision and be assigned work-related quotas, resulting in less job satisfaction. Quote, think of it more like a factory worker, the assembly line just sped up, unquote. So it's good to see that they finally, you know, starting to pay the artists and stuff. It's just they always use the thing that, you know, there's always another person that would love to have your job, and everybody would love to work in the video game industry, and so that's kind of how they were able to push their workers, but I think workers are now pushing back. And one last news item that I want to touch on, this is about an independent project, a fan-made project. It's another disappointing story, though, about him, and it's the rivalry between a big publisher and a rabid fan base turned independent developers. Vivendi Universal Games, who a long time ago, one of their incarnations used to be Sierra Online, they shut down a fan-made sequel to the beloved adventure game series King's Quest. The website for the project was kqix.com. It says, on September 30th, 2005, we received a letter from Vivendi Universal Games, also known as Sierra Entertainment, requesting that we cease and desist any further development of King's Quest IX. We always knew that this might happen, and as stated previously, we are completely willing to comply with Vivendi's request as they are the legal owners of the King's Quest trademark. As a result, we are obligated to stop all production on King's Quest IX. We are not certain what precipitated this request. Whether or not they are planning to begin development on an official King's Quest sequel is unknown at this point. Vivendi is currently re-releasing the King's Quest, Police Quest, and Space Quest and Leisure Suit Larry collections, now available for pre-order on Amazon.com. Exact details of the products are not available, but if they prove to be worthwhile, we suggest you show Vivendi that there is still a strong interest in the series. So here's the thing. I mean, I've got some words for both sides of this. First off, to the King's Quest IX people, I happen to know that there are people that worked with Vivendi on King's Quest games. The King's Quest VGA remake and the King's Quest II VGA remake, which are done by a group called Tierra Entertainment, T-I-E-R-R-A, they worked with Vivendi, and they actually have contacts within Vivendi, and were given permission to remake those games, remake music, and all of that stuff. Now, and the trade-off for that was that Vivendi Universal kind of owns those remakes, but they were still made by the fans, distributed free, and everybody was happy and got their remakes. So what I want to know is why King's Quest IX didn't go for the same thing. Why didn't they talk with the people who made the King's Quest 1 and 2 VGA remakes, see if they could get in with those same contacts and work out a deal so that they could do King's Quest IX? I don't know if they said that they've never really tried that. They said they've tried to contact Vivendi and never got a response, but apparently these other guys got a response and were able to have a good working relationship. But to Vivendi, the sad thing is that this King Quest IX team had been working on this for about 4 to 5 years. And Vivendi had to have known about it before then. they had to have. Why did they wait until now when it was almost over to send the cease and desist? I think that was kind of bad form. I think they should have done it in the beginning when the project was small, before all those hours were wasted. Hopefully they haven't been wasted, but if you look at the screenshots, they really do pull on the old King Graham to make the 3D model. I don't think it'd be easy to make it not a King's Quest game. You know, both sides probably could have done this a little bit better, but ultimately, you know, the King's Quest IX team did not approach Vivendi, did not seek the permission, and so now they have to seek for forgiveness, and they're not going to get it. They're going to get slapped with a cease and desist. You'll probably notice that we don't do the new release segment anymore. Part of the reason was we were going to make room for that long interview, since that ran pretty long. There's just too many new releases out right now that everybody knows about, so we're probably going to bring it back in January after the holiday rush, and I would like to talk sometime about the flood of games. Apparently game publishers think that, you know, the only time of the year to release games is right before the holiday season. So probably in January, when there's less games coming out than games that you probably wouldn't realize are coming out, we'll bring that segment back. But until then, there's plenty of places to get new releases, and we'll talk about some of them. A lot of people in chat are really excited about Quake 4 being released next week for the PC. So that is all the time that we have. Thanks for listening. We'll be back again next week, Sunday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, on All Games Radio Online. Check out the Shoutcast stream that's posted on our website, allgames.com/podcast. Feel free to leave a voicemail with us on any topic, or just leave a bumper for use on our show, and we do music in the middle, on our Skype line, Bobby Blackwolf Show. You can also email your thoughts and opinions to me at blackwolf@allgames.com, and you can join our official forums at allgames.com to take part in our community. But for those of you here listening live, it's time for that great All Games tradition of reading the chatters. Apulo, Cambot, Chanserv, DC Nate and his Ubuntu install, Hermdog, Anampalooza, Doomplague, Drunk Pandas, Gita, Hendrix, Nicobun, Ninjalt, Reffy, Stone Raider, THK, Bam Bam, Burning Paper Sun, Burr, Captain Roy's, Semenasuki, Chrisville 1724, D5T, Dazelle, Empty Thought, Phantaz, Fifth Dream, Helter Skelter, Hitman for Hire, Who's at Work, Ichiban, Interlogic, Nuxonic, Lord Billgod, Myru, Massman, Mecha, OSU Fan at the Creep Show, Ryu DeBurnator, Sub-Z, Tedekin, The Matrix, The Raven, Tiger Claw, Twinson, who's watching the Chappelle Show, Visid, and Wyland. Thanks so much for listening to here on the Bobby Blackwolf Show on All Games Radio Online. See you next week.
A winner is you. If you wish to comment on any of the topics on tonight's episode, you may leave a voicemail on our Skype line, Bobby Blackwolf Show, via email at blackwolf@allgames.com, or by joining our official forums at allgames.com. The views and opinions expressed on tonight's broadcast are not necessarily the views and opinions of All Games Productions. You've been listening to All Games Radio on